which I thought.
Welcome to the In Season Podcast, the hunting podcast that brings back the camaraderie of hunting, the campfire conversations about gear, tactics, hunting stories, big bucks, gobbling turkeys, and whatever else might be in season. Whether you're an avid bow hunter, a small game enthusiast, or trying to plan your next big hunting adventure, we are here for it. So let's go.
Welcome back to the In Season Podcast. Mike and I are here in Kennesaw, Georgia, and we have special guest Josh Raley with us. Josh is a habitat consultant for Whitetail Partners in the Georgia and Southeast region. Josh, welcome on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This is fun. I did not know that I was going to get to do an in-person podcast with some guys right here in Georgia, so that's awesome. I was stoked when you reached out, and so when I heard that, you know, we could do it like this, I was like, man, let's do it.
Yeah, not a lot of people come to Georgia when they think about, you know, whitetail habitat, growing habitat for deer and hunting big bucks. So it's interesting to find three people that all love this, but maybe don't live in the most ideal big buck state that people think about across the country.
Right. And it's a sad thing because the potential is here, you know, and that's what I think maybe a lot of people haven't seen, or maybe we see it in parts of, you know, South Georgia or other locations, but the potential is definitely here to grow some dandy deer.
Well, I think you see that from areas that aren't hunted as much, right? I think mm-hmm. Seek One's a great example of that. They hunt these suburban areas,
right,
that don't get hunted much. It's archery only. There's not a, you know, there's not a huge rut rifle season or any rifle season, and they're killing 180, 190, 200 inch deer in the same area that we're in. So the genetic potential is there, but is the age class and the nutrition going to allow it to get to that point? So
yeah, exactly.
It's interesting to see what can happen when deer get to 6, 7, 8, or they have the right habitat.
Yeah. It's amazing when just allowing the deer to get that extra 2 to 3 years on them, I think is just, it's tremendous. It's crazy. And so often people think, wow, my property just can't produce big deer. It's like, No, you're just shooting every 2-year-old you see. Like,
right.
There's like, if you just stop doing that, like, boom, big deer.
Well, and I think they use this, I don't want to say excuse, but this rationale of, well, if I don't shoot them, my neighbor will, mm-hmm. right? They're going to,
right.
But a lot of times the neighbor never gets a chance to either. So, and we're all responsible for that. But it was pretty cool how you guys came together. Holden, I think you reached out to Josh initially, right?
Yeah, for sure. So, Josh, I've kind of followed you on Instagram, for a little while, just because the whole habitat land thing is something that I've always been interested in. I've never had, up until this year, really, I've never had a piece of property that we could really manage, so to speak. It was right. always just, hey, it's my buddies or whoever. Hey, you can go out there, hang a couple stands, whatever. But this was the first real year that I've got access to a couple different properties where I have a little more free range. And so I was, you know, digging into, you know, what I could do and how to make these properties the most they could be for you know, me hunting. And that's how I kind of stumbled upon your Instagram and your guys' podcast and everything like that. So that's kind of how we got introduced to each other. But, you know, kind of what we were just talking about before, you know, and off record too, what's a good way, you know, we were talking about, you know, making sure your land, you know, can have the potential for those deer. How can someone go to their property and kind of evaluate it for themselves to see what first step they should take to, you know, optimize their property?
Yeah, I think that starts, you know, and this isn't the ideal answer, I think, for a lot of people, but it really starts pre-purchase. Before you buy the property, we deal with a lot of whoopses, which is fine, but it starts with pre-purchase. You've really got to be paying attention to the neighborhood around you and that kind of thing before you ever really dive in and buy the property. Most of the time, though, when people call us, they've already got a property in mind. Mm-hmm. We do some pre-purchase property reviews, which is always very, very helpful. We can tell them, you know, between these three, this is the one we feel like we could really design well and is going to help you meet your goals. But usually people come to us and they've already got a property. And mm-hmm. so the first thing that we're going to begin to look at from that property, we're going to zoom way out on a map and we're going to say, what can we do to provide a distinct value on this property that the rest of the neighborhood doesn't offer? And that could look like cover, high quality cover, because people say, oh, it's the South, it's thick everywhere. Thick doesn't mean good cover.
And it could be seasonal. There's certain times of year that it could be thicker.
Yeah.
So you're covered throughout exactly. the season, depending on the species and when they're dropping leaves or exactly. all season cover.
Exactly. Yeah. All season cover, going to hold the deer throughout the year. And then is it high quality? So just because it's thick doesn't mean that it's good. Means it's maybe better than some other places, but it doesn't mean it's good. Food could be a standout. And a lot of people say, well, you know, everything's the same. I can't do much to my property. Well, what you could do to that property to provide distinct value is just leave it alone most of the time. You know, not hunt it like your neighbors do. Or when you do hunt it carefully. That's a distinct value because your property is now sanctuary. Even if the cover is the same, the food is the same as the neighbors, well, we can zoom out and say, okay, there's a lot of pressure around us. What we're going to do here is we're going to take a really light approach, especially during those high pressure times of season. So that's kind of first step, evaluating a property. Zoom way out. What mm-hmm. can this property offer the deer herd that the rest of the properties around it can't?
Yeah, that's awesome. And like Mike said, I think a lot of people, if someone has their property already, and you know they're zooming out, right? So you need to make your property in some way different than, like you said, the neighborhood, right? With right. food, cover, whatever resources for what the deer might need that aren't there. Right.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess with that being said, you know, we're winding down the season. Is there anything right now going into the off season that people can kind of start spinning their wheels to, you know, how to make sure, you know, they're either planting the right food, you're making good bedding or whatever the case may be for the deer?
Yeah, it's a really, really good time of year to get into the timber and start to cut some of those areas where, you know, you're going to want bedding, cutting in some of those travel corridors for high odds ambush locations. I think, honestly, keeping some food on the ground, like even if it's just making sure your feeders stay full. I mean, we're here in Georgia, people feed all the time. Keep your feeders full, keep those deer full, keep them happy. If you've got locations that you want to cut, you know you're going to be cutting them, lots of hardwoods, that kind of stuff. Go ahead and put those tops on the ground. Let the deer eat on those throughout the winter. You know, there's a lot of browse gets put on the ground.
When you say cut, you're not necessarily talking just like full cutting mature trees that are going to then allow sunlight to get to the ground and create browse in future years in thick areas. You're talking as well about hinge cutting. So they're staying alive. It's creating some horizontal cover, but also the leaves are still there that they can browse on throughout the winter.
Right. So it depends on the location, depends on what tree you're cutting, depends on what your goals for that specific area are. So we're going to use a mixture of flush cutting or hinge cutting. We may flush cut and spray if we want that species to just die off and be gone. But yeah, it depends on what the actual use of that location is, but we're going to use a mix of all of it. We're going to stump cut some and let them resprout. We're going to hinge cut some, and then we're going to flush cut and then spray others. And then we may girdle some, leave it a standing tree, I'm not as much worried about girdling right now. That's work that can be done later in the year.
Okay. Okay. When I think about the property that Holden and I hunt in Alabama, again, it's 132 acres. When I purchased this last year, I didn't do that. I didn't necessarily do that.
I didn't get a phone call.
I found a good deal because the property was landlocked, and I bought some access points to allow me to access it from what would be, I guess, the north side and the west side of the property.
Okay.
But I think the things that drew me to it initially were, first of all, the value and the price of it. There was a lot of diversity of wood species there. There was diversity in elevation, and there was multiple creek systems that went through that changed elevation. I think there's like seven or eight major, not major creeks, but creeks that run through it. Or there's actually old moonshine stills that are still there, dug into the hillside.
I love that stuff, man.
Which is so
cool. I love finding that stuff.
And then it runs 1,800 feet along the Tallapoosa River, which is obviously a big river system there.
Right.
And 8 acres of it's on the other side of the river. Kind of landlocked that nobody else gets over there. I actually bought a kayak and hold on. I went over there and put a camera up. And
that's awesome.
I think we almost fell out of the kayak.
Yeah,
it was fun to be able to do.
We need a new mode of transportation to get over there.
maybe a zip line. But I love the habitat management side, but the reality is I have no idea what the hell I'm doing.
Right.
But, outside of watching a few videos, and most of my hinge cutting or cutting is largely either to clear for, you know, like a regeneration of browse or thick areas or bedding. or hinge cutting specifically for directional traffic to guide the deer away from certain areas to create traffic corridors in areas I don't want them to be by trying to block that, which creates some horizontal cover. Obviously, it can create some browse, but that's mostly what it's been outside of food plots. And I don't think I've ever designed a property thinking about access probably being the most important thing. And I think that's always like an afterthought. Like, I'm like, okay, I want to put a stand here. How am I going to access it? And I'm like, well, I should have done this or should have done that. How much does access and ways to access or multiple access points with different winds play into an ideal pre-purchase analysis of a property?
Right. So that's actually number two on the whole picture evaluation. So we're going to zoom out first, look at, you know, what can this property offer that others can't? Then we're going to zoom in and say, okay, what kind of access do we have here? Because in my opinion, access and hunting pressure is the number one thing that you can do, that you can control to improve your property. It will pay the biggest dividends in the long run.
And probably the most overlooked of both.
Well, yeah, because here's the deal. Everybody thinks their neighbor is hunting pressure, but they don't think that they're hunting pressure.
Mm-hmm.
They don't count their own, right? Because I walked in there quiet. No, you didn't. No, you didn't.
I didn't get busted. You didn't know you got busted.
Right. Mm-hmm. You got busted every deer that crossed your scent trail on the way there. And you don't have to get busted. It doesn't have to be a hard spook. They can know something's up and say, I don't like that. I don't like that over there. I'm not going to walk over there anymore. How many times have you hunted a food plot? You don't bust a single deer. You hunt it again the second day, you see a few less deer, but you don't bust any of them. You hunt it day three and you don't see anything. Well, what happened? You didn't bust anything. Well, they slowly got hip to the game. They realized that they were being hunted. And so I think that access is critical. I will avoid certain locations for most of the year simply because it's too high risk to get into a certain spot. I also will get very, very aggressive at some points of the year. Mm-hmm. Just depends on the situation. But I also love the idea of access and controlling our hunting pressure because anybody can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you've got a lease or permission property, you have no permission to touch any tree, cut anything, disturb the woods at all. You can do nothing other than show up and hunt. Well, you can still control your pressure. So you can still improve that property and the way it hunts.
So we did an episode, I don't know, it's probably been a month or two now, with Lindsay Thomas from the National Deer Association. He broke down the four factors that impact deer movement the most, right? One being time of day. Obviously, you know, dawn and dusk is when they move the most. All the evidence from collared deer. Two being the rut. Okay, yeah, they're going to move more during the rut. That makes sense. But the other two, one being food, nutrition, and then the fourth being pressure.
Right.
And I think the data that he shared from collared deer is, even with you going in the woods one time, it was something like it impacts like 30 to 40%, I think, right, of the deer activity. And it takes 3 to 4 days at a minimum for them to reset that behavior. By going in there once, mm-hmm, even if your wind is good or even if other things, like you may think you're a ghost, but they know.
Right. And even here, and I'm sure he probably shared this. I actually talked with him just a couple of weeks ago on one of my podcasts. I'm sure he shared that even if you go in there and you only alert one deer while you're there, the body language and demeanor of that deer changes in that location. And the rest of the deer begin to associate that with danger because of how they saw that deer react. It's not necessarily, oh, they all smell, 30 or 40% of the deer smelled you. Well, maybe not, but they all realized like, ooh, that doe went over there and she didn't like it. So just to be safe, I'm going to stay over here.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. That's super. You know, Mike and I mentioned, you know, we're interested in the habitat stuff, and we really have no clue what we're doing when it comes to it, though. What's your background, and how did you get involved in it, and Whitetail Partners, and everything like that?
Yeah, man, it's a long story. So we actually, when I was a kid, we got into a hunting lease that was 3,600 acres in Alabama. And so very early on, we had some opportunities to start doing some habitat improvement. We didn't know what we were doing. We were trimming areas. We were, mowing things we shouldn't mow, plowing things we shouldn't plow, planting food plots where we shouldn't do that, hanging stands where we shouldn't. We made a lot of mistakes, but we also killed some deer along the way and learned a lot during that time period. I've also just been a whitetail student just throughout my entire life. I mean, you know, other kids would go to the library and check out books about, you know, their favorite person or, you know, their favorite cartoon. I'm like checking out whitetail books at, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. Like that's all I wanted to read about. So I was consumed with that. Then I started hunting a lot in different states. So hunted Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Wisconsin, Iowa, Georgia, obviously. So, you know, covering a lot of different states and hunting a lot of public ground really taught me a lot about how deer move and seeing consistencies from place to place, deer doing deer things all over, deer reacting to hunting pressure in similar ways, predictable ways all over, but then also learning about the importance of habitat. And then, so I actually had the opportunity to move to Wisconsin in January of 2020, and that's where I met Sam, and that's where sort of the professional side of habitat management was born, was when I met Sam. Did a couple of properties with him, was out on some properties with him, was able to kind of get a behind-the-scenes look of, okay, Sam, what are you doing? How are you doing it? What's the method behind the madness here? Even got to be on a property with him that he was implementing some work for a gentleman and seeing these stand setups, these travel corridors cut in, these proper hinge cuts on the right kinds of trees put in, and really saw the way that the deer took to those and the impact that that had. That had a tremendous impact on me. And so when we got the opportunity to move back to Georgia, you know, I went to Sam. I was like, hey, man, I was really hoping I was going to get to work with you more here in Wisconsin. We got to move back to Georgia. And he was like, or we view this as an opportunity and we start Whitetail Partners Georgia. I was like, I think that's a wonderful idea.
And it's like the best of both worlds.
Right? It absolutely is. So we got to move back south. I get to be near my family again. My kids are with their grandparents and cousins. My wife's happier because it's not freezing cold all the time. And and I get to do habitat work. So.
And you spent the years of COVID in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I did. I literally went to Wisconsin. 5 weeks later, they shut everything down. And then when COVID was over, I left.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just had like an extended COVID stay, basically, in Wisconsin.
Love that. So how is that different? Obviously, I'm from Michigan, right? So I'm from the Midwest. A lot of the terrain and habitat is somewhat similar to Wisconsin, you know, in certain areas, especially northern Michigan. How does that compare? Because when I moved down south and I started hunting down here more in the last couple of years, it was like I was learning a whole new habitat completely because I was used to, Michigan type swamp, some big timber sections, and then ag with fence rows and small woodlots with almost no topography change in the lower peninsula where I was at. So then coming down here and it's pine plantation after pine plantation after pine plantation.
Aren't they beautiful?
And the only hardwoods where you have any mass crop is going to be like in the no-cut zones,
right,
along creeks or rivers and that.
Right.
And it was just so different. And then all the topography changes and having to learn how deer traverse that topography or move differently. Because where I was at, it seemed like there was more distinct bed to feed patterns, at least the property where I hunt in Michigan, because it's real wet cattail swamp. It's like the property that I have up there, it's largely just a 20-acre section of bedding. And then there's an ag field out one side of it where they always go from a destination food source.
Right.
So I went from like destination bedding, destination food, to then being down here where it's like, well, there's food everywhere. There's bedding everywhere.
Right.
Like, how am I going to hunt these deer differently now? And it was just in Michigan where you can't bait to then being down here where, you know, hasn't always been legal, but for the last 5 to 10 years, I think baiting became legal here. How is that different from habitat management? Did you have to learn that differently? How is that different for obviously the team up in Wisconsin? Because there's different tree species, different movement.
Right.
There's still deer doing deer things. But was that a challenge for you?
So not really, because it's what I grew up with. So it helped me. So my time there in Wisconsin really just accelerated my learning because, one, I got to be around deer a lot more often. But I got to witness firsthand what happens when you do things like anchor movement with good year-round food, with a major food source. If you've never hunted the Midwest or ag country, you can't overstate the impact that a large destination food source has. You can't do it. Down here in the South, the way we move away from what you find up there as far as linear deer movement. Down here, it seems like a lot more wandering. You know, how many times you see a group of does at 7 a.m., and then you see them again at 10 a.m. coming back through, and it's like, well, wait a second, what are you doing? Like, why? I thought you went over there to bed, and they just got up to walk around, and, you know. And and so I didn't have to relearn a lot, but I did have to take some of the principles that I learned from there and say, okay, how do we adapt some of those to the South? How do we bring some of the strengths of Midwestern deer hunting down to the South? But then how do we stay true to, you know, true Southern hunting with what we've got, different tree species, different, you know, grasses and forbs and different management styles. I will say, if you try to manage your Southern woods like they do the woods up in Michigan or Wisconsin, you're going to be in trouble. Real fast.
How so? Like, give me an example.
Yeah. So for instance, up there, you can get away with not disturbing the woods for long periods of time. You do that down here, your woods are going to be useless to wildlife in 3 to 5 years. Maybe a little more.
Because of the species and the speed at which they grow.
Because of the speed at which they grow. It has a lot to do with the length of our growing season. You cannot get away with not disturbing your woods here. There, winter, I mean, you go out.
It kills everything.
Winter kills everything. It looks like you get up there in April. I love turkey hunting, right? So I go up to Wisconsin every April, try to get that first turkey season. Love it. Looks like a prescribed fire went through the woods.
Yeah.
Everything is dead and gone, right? Nothing's going to bud out really well until mid-June.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you've got all this light, sunlight on the floor with warming temperatures throughout all of April and May. Well, what happens? The forest floor explodes into new growth, and it's going to do it again next year. You know where that doesn't happen? Down here in the South. You just don't have that sort of natural disturbance going on. So we have to rely on things like fire. We have to rely on things like light disking. We have to rely on things like herbicide applications. If your property's just gone too far, like we might have to come in and spray it once, maybe twice, maybe a couple of times. Maybe that's part of your normal regime. It just depends on the specific property. But that's a huge difference, though. You can't let your woods be undisturbed for nearly as long. We've got clients down in South Georgia that literally they're burning every year to 18 months.
Really?
And they have to. Because if they don't, the gallberry, the yaupon holly, the wax myrtle is going to take over, and they're not going to have any useful understory for deer, turkeys.
Interesting.
So okay. Turkeys like some of that stuff. Let me take that back before too many people start calling in and calling me out on that. But turkeys would do like some of that stuff. Deer, not so much.
Right. And ideally, I think for the, you know, the average hunter or people, they're mostly targeting deer and turkey on that. Right. So there are some things that you can probably do that are beneficial for both. Turkey might like it. Deer might like some things, but there are a lot of things that you can do that are going to benefit both of those species.
Yeah.
In addition to just wildlife in general, I suspect.
Absolutely. And that's a huge part of, you know, any management plan that I'm putting together. Obviously we're trying to make sure that we're taking the landowner's goals into account as best as we possibly can on their property. You know, we have some that say, hey, I want to shoot 170 inch deer every year. It's like, well, go buy a property in Iowa. Like, that is my management recommendation.
Yeah.
Move. But yes, it, you know, yeah, I forget where I was going with that actually.
Well, I think we were just talking about the differences of the North and the South, and you were talking about like the growing season, which I think is something that is overlooked. I don't know that the average landowner though is comfortable or even knows where to start from a prescribed fire perspective. And obviously there's some regions and counties, there's different permits and different things. And there's some agencies, some state agencies that'll come in and do that for a fee and different things, or groups like you that'll do that. So we've been talking, just to go back to this property in Alabama, because I think it gives us a real life example.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's 132 acres. There was 27 of it that was clear cut a couple of years before I bought it. So we're in a third year of it.
Okay.
But
replanted with?
13 acres of it was, or 10 acres was replanted with pine again.
Do you know what kind?
I don't, because everything else grew around it and there's stumps everywhere. So they clear cut it. Obviously they didn't clean up all the other stuff. So as we went to go try to disc up some things for food plots, there's stumps everywhere. It's just, it's either need to bring somebody in to like take those out, or I don't even know that prescribed fire would completely eliminate some of these large stumps that are, you know, a couple feet in diameter. So we probably have to, you know, skid steer or whatever it is to take all that out. But we're trying to figure out, okay, where do we want to create more of a destination food source, right? Because we have a lot of hardwoods, so we get some mass crop if we have a good, you know, acorn year, but that's hard to predict. And then it's hard to predict deer movement with that.
Right.
So we want to have more food, more spring plots, more annual, and even knowing what that might look like from a burn perspective specifically.
Mm-hmm.
What is, when you assess when something or if something needs to be burned, what does that look like? Is it the type of species that's already there? Are there invasives that we have to get rid of? What's around it? or just to create natural disturbance so it, you know, it gets thicker and there's more sunlight hitting it? When do you decide a section is appropriate for burn?
Yeah, so the number one thing that you've got to do, first and foremost, before we cause any kind of disturbance, we've got to go in and figure out, do we have invasives? And if we do have invasives, we've got to deal with it, because what will often happen is you will get a flush of that specific invasive when you disturb it. You run a fire through it, and guess what? All this stuff you didn't want comes back.
Because it's in the seed bank.
Because it's in the seed bank. So you got to make sure that part is handled first and foremost. That's probably going to look like a herbicide application. From either you, there are lots of people that contract. We don't do that. You do have to have some special permitting for some of that to be able to handle some of those stronger chemicals. But you as an individual could do it on your own property. You just can't do it commercially.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it looks like first assessing, do we have invasives here? The next thing is managing fuel load. So a lot of places that we see have actually gotten to the point that if they sent a fire through it, it's a major hazard. You know, it's so there's that fear of like, I'm going to set my woods on fire. And it's like, yeah, you might.
Because there's no fire breaks. There's a lot of leaf litter. There's just stuff.
We're talking under and mid story that are made up of highly flammable plants. Some of those things I mentioned earlier, yaupon holly and gallberry, those are going to burn like crazy. They're going to burn hot and they're going to burn fast and they're going to be almost impossible to keep up with.
So for those, you're going to either fire break around it or you're going to herbicide
We're going to fire break around it. Depending on the height of everything, we may come in and herbicide application on top of that. And mostly what I recommend though, I just hate chemicals. I don't like using a lot of chemicals. They freak me out. I don't want to be around them. You know what I mean? So I'm not a big fan of herbicide applications if we can avoid it. I like to send a mulcher in and let the forestry mulcher take charge of that. Let it get a little bit of height on top of that again, and then send a fire through.
So you remove most of the fuel, but then what's left is still controllable. It's still there.
Right. So the fuel has been brought down to an adequate level. And that's really the purpose for the herbicide application is to remove some of that fuel load to get it, you know, to kind of knock down a little bit, but also to control. I mean, because what you're going to get, you know, what really loves being burned, gallberry and yaupon holly and some of that other stuff. I mean, it'll come back really quickly, but it requires a very frequent burning regime because they are woody plants. You've got to burn that pretty frequently until you start to get some of those forbs and warm season grasses, cool season grasses, even things that you're wanting to come back.
Okay. When someone does a burn like that and they're not getting the warm season grasses or the cool, all the other grasses and native species that they're looking for, Are you going in and reseeding and planting those, or are they in? They're typically in the seed bank somewhere. You just have to eliminate and kill off the other stuff.
Yeah, they're typically in the seed bank,
so you don't ever have to come in and replant those.
You're hard pressed to find it. Usually, what happens if we're going to do something like planting? It's somebody's on a condensed timeline. They're saying, "I don't want to wait for burn cycles," which may be if we're burning every 18 months. You know, getting a dormant season and a growing season burn really, really frequent. Right? But I don't want to wait 4 or 5 years. So we'll recommend something like Quail Forever, Pheasants Forever. They have lots of really good blends. It is expensive though. So you want to come in and plant 10 acres of, you know, this, what's it called? Georgia. It's a Georgia specific blend made by Quail Forever. And I think it's $381 an acre for the seed.
Yeah.
So if you want to plant 10 acres of this, just for your seed, you're looking at $3,000.
Yeah, that's without fuel, tractors,
almost $4,000. Yeah, that's without anything else. So there can be a lot to it. So I would much rather disturb the soil and see what's there.
Yeah,
right. Okay, and mix it up too. So we're not just going to burn. So we may, you know, I always on a first burn, I love to send fire through for a dormant season burn. They're just a little less fickle, you know, send a dormant season burn through there. See what
meaning,
you got.
Meaning what time of year here in the like Georgia, Alabama area?
Oh God. I mean now.
Yeah.
Now
between now and what? End of February.
Yeah. Basically end of February into March, April, depending on where you're at in the state. I mean, basically if it's not green up yet, I mean, you start, there's a blurry line there, but yeah, the more in the dead of winter, I mean, really you see people doing it in January, February. March is kind of too far for most folks.
Because some parts of Alabama go through mid-February on their hunting season. So if someone's hunting till the end of it, they finish in February, the dormant season only gets into March. They got a short window of time when hunting season is over.
Right. My farm in Alabama, We hunt the rut February 1st through 10th.
Right.
Yeah. So that is our peak rut activity. Then things start to get green around March 15th, March 20th. Yeah, I mean, our turkey season used to begin March 15th. So, I mean, it's wild down there. So our window is very, very, very short.
Yeah. But, okay. Yeah.
You know, if someone reaches out to you and you do a land consultation for them or a habitat consultation, what all is included? Like, what all should someone expect from, you know, a Whitetail Partners consultant if they reached out to y'all?
That's a really good question. So every parcel and every customer is different. We do everything on a case-by-case basis. We mm-hmm. want to make our services within reach for everybody, everyone's goals, and everyone's budget.
Because, yeah, I was on the website, and you guys have a couple different offerings, I guess right. you can say. Yeah, I know there's the on-site one, obviously. There's right. a virtual and a few others.
Right, right, exactly. Let's go with the on-site, though. That's our bread and butter. That's what most people are going to be best served by. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested in doing this, we have had a lot, you know, quite a few clients in the past who want a virtual design, and then 2 years later they call us back and they're like, all right, we haven't actually done any of it, and now we want you to come out. Okay. You know, so it's like just kind of a buy once, cry once kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so with that, we come out, we spend time with you on your property, and we cover it thoroughly. So a lot of people, you know, think that we just ride the roads, kind of take a look, maybe look at some maps. Like, no, we're busting brush. We've got machetes out, and we're getting into the thick of your property. We're hunting it like we are an aggressive public land hunter that wants to see every nook and cranny of their new big buck.
That's spot. A good analogy.
Yeah. Right? Like that's what we're getting after. And I use that because that's what I like to do in my free time, you know, get out mm-hmm. on some public ground. But, so we're scouting it like that with you. We also have what we call our morning meeting, which is when we sit down, we talk about your goals. We've had several conversations by this point, by the way, before we mm-hmm. ever get to that. But we're talking about your goals, what you hope to accomplish on the property. Then we go out, we review the property with you. You know, a lot of clients will spend half a day with us, maybe a day with us, and then kind of turn us loose on our own. You know, depending on the size of the property, we may be there for 1 day. We may be there for 5 days. It just depends on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep. I was actually on a property 3 weeks ago. I was there for 5 days, 6 days. So it was.
And how big of a property would take 5 days?
That was 954 acres.
Okay.
954 wow. acres and mostly swamp down in southern Georgia. So yeah. there were alligators and all the other things. And it just took time to navigate the property.
Were you rocking like hip waders the whole time or what?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And the one time I didn't, I went up like well over my knee boots. And I was mm-hmm. like, I should have been wearing the stupid waders. But then when I put the waders on, I wouldn't get in deep water above my ankles. You know,
right, so it of just, course.
Just yeah, naturally.
On, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, so all the way back to what you get. So you get the on-site consultation. Then we go back into the office, and that's where a lot of the work happens. So, you know, for the hours that we spent on your property, we're going to spend a lot more behind a computer drawing mm-hmm. up a plan for you. And with that plan, you're going to have, you know, a full design with all of your stand locations, all of your food plots dialed in, all of your travel corridors dialed in, all of your bedding locations that we would like to see implemented, buck and doe bedding locations. If we think there's opportunities for buck bedding, the depth of cover is good enough, then we'll put that on there as well. We've got mock scrapes and water holes that we call for in different situations, depending on what's going on. But you're going to get a report with all of that. You're also going to get a series of videos that we make specific to you for each property, where we go through your report basically create custom videos for you that explain each part of the report and give you some of the why behind it. Because it's one thing for us to give you a written report that tells you here's what to do. It's another thing for us to take, you know, 3 or 4 hours and explain each piece of why we want you to do that there, because you're better off understanding the why. Because if you get out there and you're like, I want to move this travel corridor 30 yards this way. Well, let's think about the why, you know, mm-hmm. or where exactly should this travel corridor be on this high spot in the swamp? Well, what's the why? Why is it here? Okay. So now I know, okay, I can move it 15 yards this way instead of that way. Then you're going to get a follow-up meeting where we make sure that you own, that is, you love it, right? Like we want you to own this plan, because if you don't own it, you're not going to implement it, and it's mm-hmm. not going to do you any good. So we want you to own it. We talk about any revisions that need to be made. We clarify any questions that you have, and then we're always there as a resource afterwards. You know, once we've handed over to you the design, which is mapped out in 3D on Google Earth, you've got everything you need right there. You've got a full report, which is going to be well over 60 pages. That's going to come to you. You're going to get the videos that come to you.
Does it have pictures? I need pictures.
Oh, we got pictures. Man. Okay. We got pictures. We can do whatever you need. I would say we could do a pop-up, but then somebody's going to call and be disappointed when I don't send them a pop-up book of, little pictures that pop out.
When you said the videos, essentially if you said, hey, you need to do this or create this type of cover in this area, there's then a video resource that says like, hey, here's how you would do that in this situation.
Yeah. That is actually written in the report. So the videos are more along the lines of, hey, here's blind B7, and here's where blind B7 is, and here's how I want you to hunt it, and here's why it's here. Here's why it's here instead of there. Here's why this travel corridor wraps around this side of the downed log instead of the other side, or whatever the case may be. So we give you the why of it there. There is a section in the report, though, that tells you how to build the cover. But a lot of that, we're there for you individually afterwards to say, hey, okay, I see you're calling for this cover here. Clarify for me. And that's part of our conversations afterwards of like, and that's why we call ourselves Whitetail Partners, because we want to be a partner with you through the process. Yeah. So it doesn't end after the transactional nature of, we come out, we give you deliverables. That's not the end of it. Okay. You call us when you need help, and we talk through it with you. But one of the cool things, and I don't know if I should spill the beans on this, part of what I'm wanting to do is to add videos like that for individuals that where I can say, hey, in your report, I call for a removal of 70 to 80% of, the canopy to create bedding. Here's what 70 to 80% clear looks like. Mm-hmm. Show the video above me. Here's the plant regeneration that I would be looking for might look like on your site. The problem with that is it's so specific. And if I did one for each site, it would, we couldn't feasible.
I thought they were when I thought that that's what you were doing, I thought it was like a, hey, here's how you would do this. And here's a generic video of what this could look like that would apply to people across, at least the South.
Probably. Right. And that's kind of a long-term goal of like, generally, here's what it looks like to create bedding in a lowland site, or here's what a hillside bedding area might look like. We'd like to put some of those together, but that I just haven't got there yet. I probably shouldn't have even talked about it yet.
Let's say I'm 80 years old, or I'm not physically able to do some of the work. Do you guys, do you guys have a portion of the business that then will also do the work on their behalf, or is it the planning side mostly? And you have recommended subcontractors or affiliate partners that you'll recommend for that. Like if someone wants to bring in and have somebody else, bush hog this or fell these trees or do this or do that. Do you guys offer those services as well?
Yeah. So that's part of the business that we're working on building out right now. Okay. So we have
the actual implementation of the plan.
Correct. The actual implementation of the plan. Now we do a fair bit of implementation, but it's things like your bedding locations that we can do by hand. Essentially, it's what guys with chainsaws can do.
Yeah.
And it sounds like manual labor, so I can have just anybody come out and do it. But it is, you've done hinge cutting, right? It's very technical, right? Yeah.
The way I do it, but it probably should be
the right way, though.
Yeah, yeah. Hinge cutting done well is technical. Or bedding areas created well is technical. Travel corridors created well that aren't leaky. We call them leaky when the deer can get off of them way too easy. That's technical. And so we do a lot of that. We haven't gotten as much into, or at least I personally haven't gotten as much into some of the land clearing stuff. We do work with a network of contractors that we can either recommend. Now, I hesitate even to go that far because for a lot of parts of the state, I just haven't covered them yet. So I don't have a recommended contractor for
every town in Georgia.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. I can't necessarily get you covered. Fair. And you may call my guy will say, yeah, man, I'll come up to LAJ and cut this for you. It's going to, take $1,000 of travel expenses for me to get there. It's like, well, that's not cost
effective. Yeah. Exactly. what about if my plan, right? My plan for my property, there's a habitat component. There's a deer component. There's a, how do I hold deer? How do I have, enough food to hold a certain amount of deer per acre, whatever that might be.
Right.
What about in the Midwest, it's probably more common, but is there recommendations of, hey, I also want this to kind of self-fund itself from government CRP programs, waterway easement. I think there's some even like feathering programs that are in Alabama. There's a bunch of different like government programs that can allow some properties to create some income from themselves, whether a conservation easement or whatever it might be. Do you guys do any of any recommendations on that based on what you find on the property? I know it's so specific to states and zones and different things.
Yeah, exactly. So here in Georgia, let's say if you had a property here in Georgia, there are some things that I might recommend. So if you say, hey, I really want to burn my property, I'm going to say, hey, well, the through the Georgia Forestry Commission, and with funds from NRCS, they've got something where they can reimburse you for, I think it's like 75% of costs associated with your burn.
Okay.
And so, you know, I'm going to obviously recommend that you take advantage of that. So it's just very, very site dependent. But a lot of what we do, most of our managing around, though, is the income that's already being created by the property, namely through pines.
Right.
That, you know, a lot of folks want to keep that flowing. And so trying to work with, okay, well, how do we begin to stagger your cuts a little bit differently? You might lose a little bit of money, but if we're trying to do what's best for wildlife and what's best for your hunting, a 50 acre clear cut, not for you, bud. You know, it's not gonna serve you quite as well as 5-10 acre clear cuts
I've been hunting this pine plantation east of Atlanta a couple hours. And they did a clear cut and then they burned. And I will tell you what, from what I hunted it last year to now, it's a completely different property. When you, and there wasn't even a massive cut, but when you actually, I don't know if there was any cut, but they burned a big section. So what was very huntable came up super thick. And then they replanted in certain areas. So then there's even more bedding and more browse. And they burned last year during the rut. I was in a stand and I saw a truck come in. I was like, are you kidding me right now? I was not happy with that.
Like, I looked down and there was smoke.
My tree started to catch on fire.
It's a hunting club out there. I don't own that section of land.
Right, right.
But it's just interesting when you're rotating pines through, the habitat changes so much over any five-year window.
Right.
Because the growing is so fast of some of these pines that it's just interesting. But so one of the things that I did when I bought this property in Alabama is, since there was, Alabama has a program that I think if you can enroll in a CRP program or something like that, if you've had row crops for over like 5 years, right? But what I was able to do is essentially get my property taxes significantly reduced because I had at least 5 acres of a planted pine that was there.
Right.
I think it was 5 acres. And it allowed me, maybe don't, a dollar saved is a dollar earned, right? I didn't make money, but I paid less money from it. So I think there's programs like that too, that people may not know about.
There's a lot of them. There's a lot of really simple ones out there that even like the state of Georgia, and it doesn't mean everybody's going to get approved for it, but simply making the commitment that you're going to improve and that you are improving the wildlife, and you can show, hey, here are the projects that I've done. Well, you end up getting some money in your pocket. And, you know, I've heard of some people who go down that road and it's like you're saying, well, it paid for the taxes, or I paid less money for the property this year. Other folks have said, man, I spent $5,000 and I walked away with a $15,000 check. Like I walked in, right. I walked out in the black, you know, but it just depends on your state, your whatever of these you qualify for. And there are a lot of them that they're pretty specific. You know, I mean, not every property is going to match up with that, but here in Georgia, I'm generally going to try to help you to the best of my ability, figure out which of those you're going to qualify for at any given moment. But the best that I can really do is to point you to the resource, because those folks at the Forestry Commission, they know through and through. So the best thing I can do is give you their phone number and you talk with them. And
but that's a, if someone has that a goal, that's part, can be part of at least providing the resources or recommendations.
Yeah, you've seen on other absolutely. And one of the other things that we'll do as well. So like if we've got foresters or people trying to look at something like that, we will, on your behalf, because we know the plan inside and out, we know your property inside and out, we'll talk with those people with and for you. Right. So we can kind of navigate some of that conversation. So if they're like, well, what is, you know, they start asking you, well, what are you trying to plant here? What are you going to do with that? And you're like, I'm not real sure yet. Well, I'd be more than happy to talk with the forester for you to try to talk through how we're going to do the burning regime on this property, or however that looks.
Okay.
So this may or may not bring up a funny story that you have or whatnot, but I imagine, you know, your guys' plan has, you know, a ton of detail, you know, all that good stuff. I mean, I just can imagine being in your shoes and you talking to someone that has hunted this same property for 20, 30 years, whatever the case may be, right? And, oh, I know it. Like the see, I figured this would bring up a funny story. And I feel like you know where I'm going with this, where they're like, oh, I don't need your help. You know, everything, I've got everything squared away. I've been here, like I said, 20 years. I've killed numerous deer, whatever. What would you say to that person, you know, where you can bring value to him and that them and that property, even though they've been on a certain piece for, you know, however long and have such a great history with it?
Right. What I would say first and foremost is, yeah, absolutely. You've been on that property for 20 or 30 years. And yes, you know that property better than I do. Hands down. You absolutely know it better than I do. But what I can offer you is another set of eyes and a different perspective. Mm-hmm. I can offer you fresh eyes. And anybody who's been doing anything for 20 or 30 years understands the value of a pair of
fresh eyes.
Right? Like anybody that's been around that long gets that piece. And then the different perspective. And that just comes down to the individual. Do they want a different perspective? And if not, that's okay. You know, I'm not in the business of trying to convince someone that they need my services. But for those that do, then, you know, I think we do offer a helpful perspective. And I will just say some of the feedback that we get. Number one, we get a lot of people who've been hunting. I can think of one customer, one client right now. I've got a great, I mean, our business relationship has evolved into a friendship at this point where we're going to turkey hunt together this spring. I mean, we've, you know, really good guy. But one of the things we're talking about as we're walking his 30 years in his family property is, I've never been here before. Oh, wow, I've never been here before. Oh, wow, I've never been to this part of the property before on 145 acres. You know, very, very steep, difficult terrain. But because we're putting boots on the ground when I'm there, like I said, we're getting to spots that he's literally never seen before. Or, oh yeah, man, I was back in here when we pulled out so-and-so's deer one time and it was at night, but I remember thinking, wow, there's a lot of sign, we should come back, and we never did, you know? And so we're discovering those things. So with a fresh set of eyes and a different perspective, I think I can provide some value for you.
Well, we all create our own bias. And when you spend that much time on a property, right, you have a natural bias that is going to cloud your judgment or cloud the opportunity for you to see things differently.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I do have to share this buddy of mine now, his success story from the year. So they had this spot that they loved to hunt and they hunted it all the time. And I was like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to really sweeten up that spot. We're going to put some other things around it, some bedding, some another food plot actually down the way a little bit. And here's what I want you to do. I want you not to hunt that ever until perfect conditions. And he was like, oh man, I've killed all my biggest bucks there. Like, this has been a great spot for me. I was like, don't hunt it. Just wait. And so he did, he waited. And then he called me during Thanksgiving break. And he said, hey, I've got a southeast wind tomorrow. It's perfect for that spot. Do I go in? I said, tomorrow's the day, go. And I sent him into the spot and he killed a buck that morning. Might be the biggest buck he's ever killed off that property.
That's awesome.
And it's just because he kept his pressure off of that specific location.
Well, you can make the perfect habitat plan and you can have the best cover and the best food and water source nearby.
Right.
But human intrusion is going to ruin all of that.
Oh, absolutely.
Every time.
And here's the thing. You can have a really healthy deer herd. And you can have a really great hunting property, and your deer can be fat and happy and all over the place at night, you know, and right, during the day, they're just not, you're not seeing them. And why is that? Well, their daytime movements are so constricted because of the way you're hunting the property, because you're alerting them. They're still going to eat that food plot. It's just going to be when you're not there.
They've patterned you better than you've patterned them.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're totally fine with that. They're not sad they didn't get to get out there, you know, 30 minutes before dark. Like, they're like, oh, that's fine.
Yeah.
They'll wait. They got nowhere to be.
So we talked about some of the pre-purchase type of assessment, mm-hmm, right? Looking at everything. We've talked about what it looks like if you were to come in and how you might assess a property and how that sits up. Can you think of, I think about the property that I have in Michigan. It's a really small parcel. It's like 22, 23 acres, mostly cattail swamps with like 5 to 8 acres of woods. But we've been accessing that until the last couple of years as we started, you know, doing more and investigating more on how we should access this and blowing out deer and doing that. And I've only owned it for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. But some properties are set up in the way where there's only one way to access it, because it's blocked on private from different areas outside of selling it, because it's not an ideal property. Or
that's what I was gonna say.
Or not hunting it when the conditions aren't perfect for that one access. Like, are there really any other options? Because there's a lot of properties, especially when you get into, like, I think about the Midwest, where it's you know, Ohio, Michigan, where it's smaller parcels, 20 acres 40 acres. There's not a lot of different access points in different areas. How do you think about that? Because it seems like you either got to sell it and start fresh, or you just can't hunt it in certain conditions and you better find another place to hunt.
Right. So a lot of it just comes down to your goals. What really is your goal on October 28th and that weather came through? What's your goal on that day? Do you want to go enjoy a really great hunt or have a great opportunity at a good buck? Or is your goal to hunt your property. So if the conditions aren't right, you're 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, 999 times out of 1,000 going to do more damage than good on your own property if you're going in when the conditions are not right. And it's almost never worth it. I hear it time and time again. I was just on the phone with
a client. So you don't love the you can't kill it from the couch type of mentality?
I do. I do. I'll come back to that, actually, because I do love that you can't kill them from the couch. And I'll give a plug for my other favorite style of hunting here. But, yeah, you gotta leave it alone for that if it's not perfect, if it's not right. You know. Now, there are times to be aggressive. October 30th might be that time. Your trail cameras might be telling you, hey, you need to be here no matter what. Belly crawl your way to the stand if you have to, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot we can do, too. We're going to plant screening. You know, there's a lot. This is assuming we've done everything we can on the front end to make sure that we have mitigated your access as much as possible or the impact of that access. The other thing that I'm going to encourage you to do is find your favorite piece of public that's local and hunt the snot out of that thing.
Yeah.
Hunt it like you've got nothing to lose because nobody else out there does either. You know, yeah. Like, I mean, everyone.
If you just want to go spend time in the woods, don't blow up your property that you're right. building mm-hmm. for something. Hunt something else that's already been blown up and
yeah.
have a good time out
exactly.
there.
Exactly. And I love hunting public land. Absolutely love hunting public land. I go to Wisconsin every year still, hunt public land up there. Get good shots at really big deer there every mm-hmm. year. Don't always kill them, but I get shots at them every year. And so, you know, there's a lot of good hunting to be had out there. But it really just comes down to your goals. If your goal is to be on your property in your favorite stand on October 30th, because that's what really brings you that peace inside that you're looking for from hunting, then go do it. You know, nothing's saying you can't. But if your goal is for those deer to feel comfortable and for every time you go in there to be absolutely lethal and to put no pressure on those deer that you don't have to, I think you know what to do.
Yeah, stay out of it.
Yeah.
All right, you said you had something to say about that you can't kill it from the couch.
Oh, yeah, that was it. Go hunt the public land. Find some permission spots.
Yeah.
You know, one of the best things I think you can do is get permission on the neighboring properties. If you've got several neighbors around you who are non-hunters or maybe they just don't hunt
pressure
their
land to push them to yours.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. If they don't care about hunting and they're not hunting, then, you know, treat their land. I mean, obviously with great respect and be very grateful for what they're offering you because a free place to hunt these days is not easy to find.
Yeah, you know, that I need to bring that up because I have permission and I think it's 24 acres or 22 acres in ball ground. But it's, I mean, the plot's a rectangle just like this. And the only way to come in is from the east side and the property runs west.
Right.
So if you have a bad wind, you'll.
It's long and narrow with one like driveway logging road that goes right through the.
And so if the wind is wrong and you're going in there, you're going to bust everything out.
Right.
I know the landowner, the neighbor, he doesn't hunt. I need to ask him for access rights, at least,
yeah,
right,
absolutely.
To get on there. I haven't even thought about
absolutely.
That. Because he's fine with me and my buddy who owns that property. He's fine with us turkey hunting his land and everything like that, too. We haven't got deer rights, but, I mean, even just access rights
right.
to have a different way into that parcel yeah. would be huge
yeah.
for us.
Absolutely. And you would be surprised at how many people, because they want to be a good neighbor, are willing to do that for you. One of the first things, when I come to a property that has challenging access, one of the first things I say is, do you know this neighbor? Do you know this mm-hmm. neighbor? Do you know this neighbor? 6 or 7 guys out of 10 don't know any of their landowning neighbors.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. Very, very few of them know them. Even my buddy, who our family's been here for 30 years, he didn't know any of those folks either. But everybody has an idea, or a lot of people have an idea, that the relationships with your bordering landowners are antagonistic, right? Because mm-hmm. there's a boundary between us, therefore we're at odds and competing with one another, either for the deer or whatever. We get on this property, we're back in places that we've never been to, right? Quote unquote. We're putting up posted signs, actually. The terrain was really,
like
really...
No trespassing signs.
Yes, yes. Okay. Putting up no trespassing signs. So... and so as we're marking this property, we get to the boundary line and we see the guy drive up to this other property on the very back end. And he kind of like looks over at him and I'm like, I got nothing to lose. This guy doesn't know me, you know? So I wave at him and I go walking over onto his property. Hey, how you doing? And the guy jumps out of his truck, and he is so happy to see somebody. He's like, man, I'm so – how you doing? Did y'all buy this property, you know? Because it had changed hands, but within the family.
Gotcha.
And by the time we left, he had been offered not only to be able to bring his implements and tools and vehicles back through there, but, hey, if you're ever hunting back here, just park right here. Park here, walk up the hill, do whatever you need to for hunting, you know? And the guy hunts his own land. He didn't care. He's like, ah, you're not going to mess with my deer, you know? And – but just like that, so yeah. Few people think about asking the neighbor because they're like, I don't want to put them out, or I don't want them to get upset, or, you know, there's that antagonistic assumption, and it's often not the case.
We've tried to make contact with neighbors largely just to say, hey, if you hunt and you shoot something, it comes over here, shoot me a text. Like, I'll come help you track it, or vice versa. Like,
right.
I want to make sure I'm not trespassing. I want to make sure I can get a hold of you. I want to do what's right for the animal. But it's largely like post-harvest if something happens and a deer runs across the property line. Right?
Yeah.
That's most of the neighbor type of relationships that I've had. And it's been good. Right. And we'll talk to each other, but not from an access standpoint.
Right.
Or a hunting standpoint.
Right. And I think a lot of times you could even just say, like, depending on how their property lays out, right? Like, you're oftentimes not hurting anything if you just drive one corner of their property and park your vehicle there and come in from the other direction. Not a big deal.
Yeah.
It's not going to have a lot of
impact. That's
fair. Yeah. That's a really good point. And I think it kind of brings up too, like, the antagonistic thing between, you know, landowners or hunters. We've talked about it on the podcast before, but just trying to break down the barriers, right? Between hunters, right? Like you said, it's not really going to bother anything if that person comes across the corner of your property to, you know, get a different access to his property to hunt deer. You know, it's not really going to blow up your situation all that much, but it's going to help,
right,
you know, build the camaraderie between, you know, hunters and the community that we have and everything like that. So I think that's
right,
you know, a great thing for people to do.
Yeah.
Josh, how do you think about bow hunting versus gun hunting in the way a property would set up?
Do you guys know Mark Haslam?
I don't.
Mm-mm. All right. So Mark Haslam, Southeast Whitetail. So he was Deer Manager of the Year 2020.
Oh, okay.
From National Deer Association. Good guy. So he changed my mind on this topic. And are you asking specifically about setup? Are you asking about, you know, about the property and the pressure that they put on, or how does?
Yeah, I think about it. I was watching a couple of videos or listening to, like, Drury or somebody talk about this, and he was talking about the type of food plots that he plants. And again, we're talking tens of thousands of acres in different areas,
right?
But that certain crops are more appealing to deer at different times of year based on when they're, you know, most edible or palatable or whatever it is, and that early season those are closer to his, you know, stand or box blind, and late season they go further away. I'm just thinking about when you think about stand locations, it's when you're developing a property, it's probably important to know, like, hey, I'm going to bow hunt 90% of the time. So does that change stand locations? Does that change, you know, how much cover you open up, how much food you have, where that food is? I'm just wondering how that changes your plan. If someone says, that's my goal, is I'm going to bow hunt way more, or that's what I enjoy doing, so I want to set it up more for that. How does that change a property plan?
Yeah, that changes a lot. So if you're going to be primarily a bow hunter, we're going to have to put a lot into not only our travel corridors. They've got to be really, really beefed up, right, for us to.
And they can't leak.
And they can't leak. Mm-hmm. They cannot leak. And here's the thing that we also lack that the Midwest has: pinch points.
Right.
We don't have nearly the, even in hill country here, we don't have the same pinch points that they might in the Midwest, right? And there are some spots that do. You get, the more topography you get, the more pinch points you've got to work with. But the problem is there are just so many of them. You don't have the two large agricultural fields, you know, the classic pinch point where they butt up to each other and there's a strip of timber 50 yards wide. Like, you don't have a lot of that here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to create those pinch points well with our travel corridors, with barricades and other tools that we can use. We've got to have our food plot architecture totally dialed in, all the way down to what we're planting, where we're planting it in the food plot, how the food plot is shaped, how the cover and screening is shaped in the property, how we're steering deer movement through that food plot. So there's a whole lot that goes on to put the deer exactly where we want to go. And we've actually moved towards, because of our confidence level in our mock scrapes, our confidence level in our travel corridors and that kind of thing, we'll oftentimes, if it's a bow shot, you've got one, maybe two shooting lanes.
Mm-hmm.
And those are going to your mock scrape.
Yeah.
Because you've got to let the habitat plan and the design that you've put together do the work for you. If you're not letting it do the work for you and you go in there and you've tried to put six different shooting lanes in here, because what if he sneaks by me?
You have no cover.
You have no cover.
You get skyline.
You're busted.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're and you probably got busted from 230 yards away before you ever knew he was there.
Holden, you got skyline busted a couple times this year.
I have. It's easy to do. It really is easy to do. But you know,
we all have.
Yeah. And, you know, gun hunting, I used to think, and this is what I was saying earlier, Mark Haslam changed my mind. I used to think that gun hunting put more pressure on a property than bow hunting did. So I always wanted to bow hunt properties. I've changed my mind on that totally. I think gun hunting puts less pressure.
Is that because the proximity of you to the animals?
Yep. It has everything to do with proximity and has everything to do with where I have to walk to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to walk that extra 150 yards to get in there.
You're more likely to sound bump them even if the wind's in your face.
Right. You're more, and they're more likely to cross your path on the way.
And get
on
your
the
ground center or whatever the case may be.
When I think about hunting pressure during gun and deer, I think, you know, I think about opening day in Michigan, right? November 15th every year. There's not as many bow hunters, but the Orange Army is in full force.
Right.
So when I think about hunting pressure during gun season, I think about the volume of hunters, not necessarily how my pressure changes. But I think I agree with what you're saying there. But this hunt club that I'm in, that's, you know, 900 acres, nine guys in it, during bow season, I'm by myself.
Yeah, you're the only one out there.
There's one other guy that we've had on the podcast that's a good friend of mine that we're in this hunt club together. But outside of the two of us on 900 acres, but once gun season opens up, it is, the pressure is just everywhere. So then I'm trying to plan where I'm going, and we do some habitat work there, but we can't do a lot of cutting. It's mostly, it's mostly food, and food plots and some things like that.
Well, let's talk some more off air whenever you want to talk about some more stuff you guys could do. Cause there's a couple of things you can do when you're limited.
Okay.
Unlike
lease ground. What I've tried to do is essentially say, where is the pressure from everybody else? And let me then hunt the exit corridors from where they're pressuring them to me. And I sit, you know, an hour before they go out in the evening, and I sit 45 minutes to an hour after they get out in the morning to say, okay, if they're bumping deer, they're coming to me. And I've tried to change that there, but yeah, we got a couple things we should talk about off record. Cause obviously the property in Alabama that I own that we have can do anything with that we want.
Right.
And then the 900 acres or so in the hunt club that I'm in that we have the ability to do, you know, some more food and some food plots and some minor cutting, but we can't do any stump type cut in obviously their pines, which is their revenue source for that.
So for sure.
That's just really interesting when I think about the pressure concept from bow versus gun and what that is.
Yeah. It, because I always thought guns go bang, therefore they're more pressure.
Yeah, exactly.
But it all has to do with proximity and just what you can get away with. Because when you get into really designing your locations, you can really start to back some of those tree stands off, and you can shoot a 60-yard shot through the timber with a rifle. Actually, looks like a really long shot. It can feel like a really long shot. You know what I mean? But if you really say, okay, this is a 30-06, what's my effective range? Well, can I begin to back off and take advantage of more of that range? Well, if so, then let's design it as such. And let's maybe spend a few more days at the range this year, and let's get a little bit better at it.
Yeah, you don't need a rifle hunt out of your bow stand.
Right, exactly. Right? And that's, you know, we grew up doing that.
Yeah, no, exactly.
You know, growing up, man, I'd hunt the same stands for bow and rifle season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when we shot one with a rifle, we shot it at 40 yards. with a 30-06. And it's like, what'd you do that for? I don't know.
Well, I think especially if you're getting into, if you're going to step that out, then optics makes a huge difference.
Oh,
and the type of, the quality of optics and what you can do on it. It can make 150-yard shot feel like a 60-yard shot with the right glass.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Wow. That's super interesting to think about for sure. I know you have a long drive ahead of you tonight, so I don't want to keep you too long. But you know, what are some of the things for 2024 that you got going on? I know when we were on the phone, your consulting season was just about to get gearing up. So you're kind of right in the beginning of your consultant season. So what's the rest of 2024 look like for you?
Yeah. So right now we are in the throes of consulting season. So we're booked out pretty far. It won't be too long before we're booking for winter 25. It's been really good, but we narrow that window down because we want to provide tremendous value to our clients. So a lot of consultants out there will come any time of year. You want to have me in July? Yeah, I'll come out there in July. Well, I can't provide you value on your ground in July is just the reality. I can see on the ground in July about as well as I can see from a topo or aerial map.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we stop once green up happens, whatever that looks like. That's the close of our quote unquote consulting season. We will start to do some habitat work there. So the rest of the year, we're going to be focusing on building up our team of contractors around the state that are guys that we know we can trust to do the job and do it well. Because I don't want just somebody that knows how to work machinery. I want to know that this person gets what we're trying to accomplish with a travel corridor first.
Right? They understand the why behind what they're doing.
Exactly. Right? Food plot architecture and all that. So we're going to focus on building that out. I'm also wrapping up with a real estate license right now. So one of the things that I want to start to help my clients do is, number one, market and sell their properties when they're ready to upgrade or move on from their specific property, but also find those properties on the front end, because so often I'm coming in later, in the process, or I'm working with those guys that they've already gotten it down to one or two, and they're like, well, which one do you think? And you've got to be careful as a non-real estate agent or salesperson. You've got to be careful what you say, what you don't say, right? And I would just rather go ahead and get the license and just not have to deal with that.
Yeah. Cut out the middleman.
Yeah, I'll tell you exactly what I think about this property. You know?
So I have a couple questions still.
Sure.
Just as a bit of a closing remark, because I know you're driving to South Carolina to do some work here, right?
I am. I've got consultations for the next several days in South Carolina.
Well, actually, we appreciate you stopping in, and hopefully it wasn't too far out of your way, right? We only live about 45 minutes.
It's on the way. I think if it's out of the way, it was like 15 minutes.
Okay.
So
perfect. We can make that work. Yeah. So someone is trying to do work on their own land.
Right. Okay.
Maybe they haven't reached out yet, or they don't have the funds to reach out, even though you guys make packages for just about everything. Maybe they're stubborn. Maybe they don't want to show that they don't know what's going on, or maybe they just want to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. What are the first three things that are the most important that they should assess when looking at their property?
Yeah. Number one is going to be that big zooming out piece. You got to look and see what can your property add that will set it apart from the rest of the properties. And whatever it adds that the other properties around you can't, you need to do it in spades. It needs to, people say, oh, well, my neighbors don't have food, so I'm going to put in, a quarter acre food plot here and a quarter acre food plot there. It's like, that's not what I'm talking about. Mm-mm. I'm talking, we want a lot of food.
Just go all in with it. Once you identify what's missing.
Right. Lean into it hard,
Overkill's underrated.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's a big one. Number two is going to be that access. Like I talked about, let's figure out, okay, how am I accessing this? And a lot of times I'm going to encourage you to go walk circles around some of your blinds and see how the deer are skirting you, because you can probably figure it out. Yeah. Like they've probably got you patterned. You can probably figure out how they're getting around you and begin to work around that. And then I think just taking a hard, honest look, the number of people that feel like have a good understanding of their property, but maybe haven't done the work of boots on the ground scouting in the winter, during the off season like they should, or like maybe they used to before, 10 years ago, before they really felt like they knew the property well. Get back into doing some of that stuff and figuring out, where you need to do things. And I'll throw in one more here. Once you get a lot of that stuff figured out, you've got to start to anchor the movement with something. If they're forever just eating on whatever, wherever, and they're forever just bedding wherever they want to lay down for that day, you're not going to have good hunting, and you're going to pressure them more because their movement patterns are less predictable.
Yeah, they're erratic. You're going to run into them when you're not expecting it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we've got to start to turn down the number of human deer interactions where we don't want them happening. So got to anchor it.
I like that. So the second piece of this, I think, is more, we've been talking for a little over an hour, a little bit pre-record, but you guys do other podcasts where people can learn more about this. So talk about some of the places that people can find more information, more specifics. This was literally just like a teaser, right?
And
a little bit selfish for Holden and I to talk about the properties that we hunt.
That's all right. I've enjoyed it. And
what we can look for. But where can people find more of that, whether in audio, video, whatever form of way they want to find content?
Right. So we've got a team now. We just grew to 7 individuals actually with Whitetail Partners.
Okay.
Serving basically the entire eastern half of the United States. We covered 25 states last year. We're all on all the social medias, Instagram, Facebook. You can find us in all those places. We have our Design, Build, Hunt podcast, which is an audio podcast, but also a YouTube podcast. as well. And on that podcast, we put a lot of other stuff on our YouTube channel as well. We got tons of videos that we're putting up there. We've made a concerted effort to do better with our resourcing this year. But one of the things that we're most excited about, and we've gotten a lot of good feedback from, is when we're taking designs and we're actually breaking them down. So we're saying, hey, this is a 40. And, you know, so Greg or Sam designed it. Like, let's talk about it. Just last night, we were looking at a 100-acre piece that only ended up having 5 stands on the entire property. 100 acres, 5 stands, right? And
probably all set up for... Did you guys set it up with 5 stands, or that's what the guy before had?
Oh, no, we set it up with 5. Okay. We set it with 5 because of his style of hunting and his specific goals and what he had to keep on one part of the property. So I won't say too much. Maybe folks go check that out. But we break these designs down and tell you the why behind all of them. So lots of good content coming out.
So Design Build Hunt podcast. What's the YouTube channel called?
It's called Whitetail Partners.
Whitetail Partners. Yep. Okay. Whitetail Partners. Same as the organization.
Yep.
And we'll tag all that in all the show notes and everything.
Perfect.
So cool. Colden, what else you got?
I mean, that's really all I got. I mean, if you own a piece of property, thinking about getting a piece of property, you know, reach out to the Whitetail Partners team, no matter where you are. And then, you know, don't be intimidated if you don't have, right, 100 acres or 200 acres, right? You guys do any property size?
Oh, yeah. I've managed all the way down to 4 acres.
Exactly. So
4?
4.
Okay.
4 acres.
So yeah, reach out to them, check out their podcast, their YouTube channel. Like Mike said, we'll have everything linked in the description for you guys to get in contact with the Whitetail Partners team. Josh, I appreciate you making the way up here, having you on and everything like that. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you guys later.
I got a million questions, but I don't know if we have enough time for all that. So we'll have to do some follow-up. I'm going to go watch some YouTube videos myself, but appreciate you coming in, and hope everybody enjoyed this and learned a little bit along the way. And trying to figure out, you know, what your property is capable of, not what it's been doing. It may be good now, but it could be even better. And you never know until you figure that. Until you ask for help and get a second set of eyes. So appreciate it. Thanks, Holden, for coordinating. Josh, thanks for showing up, man. This was great.
Really, thank you guys for having me. This was a lot of fun. We'll have to do it again.
Absolutely.